Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
She thinks you're swell. Got the makings of a dance hall girl. Your low-cut frock and your bird's nest hair. Stiletto heels and the way that you swear. She said to take you back to see my folks again. On Sunday. Looks as though there's nobody in. They've all gone out to see my Auntie Renee. Don't you worry, you just come right in. I'm sure we'll pass the time till they come home. Well, let me take your coat, kick off your shoes, warm your toes. Try the sofa. It's getting dark, we'll miss the late night bus. It's only 8, well I'm not taking any chances. What's that noise? Why'd they come back so soon? Straighten your dress, you're really looking a mess. I'll wet my socks, pretend we just got caught in the rain. Oh, you're so rude.
You're So Rude by Faces from their album A Nod Is As Good As A Wink to a Blind Horse. I love that title. And it was released on the 17th of November in 1971 on the Warner Brothers label.
Now, this track was on the album that was recorded after Every Picture Tells a Story by Rod Stewart, of course. And Rod Stewart produced that album with a lot of the Faces on it, and
yeah.
That was and this did really well because it was it came right off the back of Maggie May, really, you know, the Maggie May single, so they were massive at this time. But interesting, the production, I actually controversially prefer the production on Every Picture Tells a Story that Rod Stewart did,
yeah,
than this, because I think it's dirtier. This, the bass, it's obviously direct injection, it's compressed. And Glyn Johns, who's the producer and engineer on this,
yeah,
or co-producer, I don't think everybody said it was a definitive album, and I think the songs are better, and I think consistency-wise it is really cool, but it's not got that grit Every pitch tells a story. Do you know what I mean?
I agree with you. It's really weird. And I think partly the texture's missing because Rod Stewart's not singing lead. And it's an odd thing for me because with Ronnie Lane singing the lead on that, when I played the song, it's like, yeah, let's put this first over the show with it. It's because I feel like it's home. There's that feel with the band. I love them so much. I cannot tell you how much I love this band. And I just love everything about them, but I know what you're saying because it's not quite there. In the room.
It sounds a bit safe as well. It sounds
You're right, as well.
Glyn Johns was a bit of an authoritarian in the studio. He didn't like any malarkey. He just liked to get down
get
to
on
it
with
and record.
It.
None of that sort of stuff.
Behave.
I think the Faces were a bit of a good time rock and roll band, weren't they?
And I think that's something that's really inspired me about them, though, is, you know, it's like every picture tells a story, isn't it? When they just fall into the groove at the very beginning of the album. And I love its messiness. I love its imperfection because it makes me feel like they're real. And there's a feel with that as well. It's not a digitalised, quantised kind of perfection.
Well, Ronnie Lane was, I think he was quite pissed off with the whole Faces thing because he didn't get a lot of time to sing.
No.
You know, because Rod Stewart obviously took the lead on most of it. And Rod Stewart, I mean, he was he's a magnificent singer.
I was gonna say, he's a bit of a force to be reckoned with. So I'm sorry, though, but, you know, there's just chalk and cheese. There's just no comparison. I mean, it's a textural level that he just can't give from using his vocals as an instrument.
Yeah.
You know. That's it.
And on that, of course, Ronnie Wood is playing a solo all the way through it, which is very funny. And it's quite loud in the mix as well. It's quite up there, you know.
Yeah.
And it's just one long solo. And I love him because of his rhythm, actually. His lead on that's really nice. It is very much a Faces sound, that, his lead. But, I do like it when he's chugging it out, you know.
Well, they released four studio albums between 1970 and 73, and they were one of the top grossing touring acts of the early 70s. So they were getting something right. We definitely know that. I mean, it was their most successful album worldwide. It went to number 6 in the USA and number 2 in the UK. So, you know, get in there.
Yeah.
Well, I just love them.
I think they made a bit of cash from it, so. And that's the main thing. But, you know, well, it's not the main thing. The art's the main thing. But anyway, we love the Faces and we have them on a lot in the house. And sadly missed that band, sadly missed. We'll be right back. Motorhead by Motorhead, of course, released as a single the 10th of June 1977. I remember it. And as part of the album Motorhead, released 2 months later on the 21st of August 1977 on Chiswick Records. Now,
no
bass.
Wow.
Terrible recording. The recording is really, it sounds really horrible.
What do you do with Lemmy? What do you do with this man? I mean, he's just an incredibly powerful presence and personality, isn't he, as well?
Yeah, force of nature he was, you know.
I mean, can you tell? I'm just listening to that song, I just think, what were you doing, man? I mean, it was fantastic. It was just so angry and... Well,
and the thing is, 77, that's, you know, punk was happening at this time, but they were accepted. They were really, really accepted by everybody because they were sort of, they were rock, real rockers, you know. They looked rocky. They looked really, you know, grisly and like a rock, 70s rock person would look.
Yeah.
But they were embraced by the audience of punk. Because because of the anger and I think of the fierceness of the performance, you know?
Well, it's odd, you know, because, of course, I know Motorhead, so I thought, where did it all start? So they were formed in June 1975 by Lemmy after he got sacked from Hawkwind in the May after being arrested in Canada for drug possession.
Indeed.
So we know about that because we've watched the documentary as well. And he said his aim... This is why I've put don't read in red on this, because I wanted you to know this first without knowing what I'm going to say. So Lemmy said that with Motorhead, his aim was to concentrate on very basic music. Loud, fast, city, raucous, arrogant, paranoid, speed freak, rock and roll. It will be so loud that if we move in next door to you, your lawn will die.
Fantastic. Well... and the first album, though, when they first started recording, did they record with Dave Edmunds at Rockfield Studios?
And the record company didn't think they were going to be commercially viable, so they shelved it.
Yeah, but they re-released it later on.
A couple of years after they got success. Because this is the thing, you know, I mean, sometimes the research for this show is like unthreading spaghetti.
Well,
that's
something
thrown
that
on the
you
floor.
Didn't pick up here, and I've got here, because this was produced, actually, by Speedy Keen.
Yeah, Speedy Keen.
And Speedy Keen, of course, was Thunderclap Newman. He wrote,
Bananas,
which was on last week's show, Something in the Air.
Do you know what? It was because I was looking left and I didn't look up to my top right and go, I looked at that name and I thought, yeah, I know that. See, because I'm really terrible. It takes me ages to really make the connections, as it were.
I'm very badly recorded at Escape Studios. But anyway, that's another story.
Well, this is a story I want to tell you as well. So Lemmy had a contract under United Artists, by a guy called Andrew Lauder, who was the A&R man for Hawkwind, so he knew them. So that's when they went to Rockfield, and that's when Dave Edmunds... produced them, and they sacked off the drummer at the time, a guy called Lucas Fox, and that's when they got in, I love this, Filthy Animal Taylor.
Indeed.
I mean, honestly, it's like cartoon characters. It's fantastic, isn't it? Well,
Fast Eddie on guitar.
Exactly. That's another one. I'm giggling because I don't really know these names. I'm thinking, what is going on here? So,
well, they're all dead now, the whole lot of them, you know, which is, it's very sad, but it's kind of...
Don't say that. I know they live on.
Well, they do.
They do. Know. They live on.
Because, and I'll tell you now, every time I hear a Motorhead track, it always brings a big smile to my face. I always remember that documentary, which is one of the greatest documentaries. If you're a music lover, it's a must-see.
Yeah, you've got to watch it.
You know, because it's fantastic. It's kind of sad in one way, but it's right. It's really cool. Because
but it's true.
He
it's
didn't
real.
Care. All he was into was the music.
And I think he did care. And I think what he was unswayed by... people who would rather he did something else. I think if he wanted to wear his hot pants shorts, right, then he wore his shorts. And even though the guys thought shorts were below your knees, his version of shorts were shorts. So this is the beauty of that. And I know he's a bit of a naughty boy as well, a lot of a naughty boy. But what I love is the fact that they were all sort of broke. And then their mate, Ted Carroll, who started Chiswick Records, he basically they were going to do a farewell gig at the Marquee, and they were splitting up because it just wasn't going anywhere. So he asked Ted to bring down a mobile recording studio or something. And anyway, the Marquee wanted 500 quid. And he went, I'm not doing that. I can't afford that, and I don't want to pay that money. So he paid for them to go to Escape Studios for 2 days. But under the premise of recording a single, well, within 2 days, they'd recorded 11 tracks.
Wow.
So this is the funny thing. And here's another friend of ours, biographer Joel McIver.
No.
Who wrote in his book, Overkill, The Untold Story of Motorhead.
No.
Exactly. Now, well, Joel.
Yeah, well, Joel McIver is the editor of
Bass Guitar Magazine. And Joel emailed me a few months ago and asked me if I'd like to do an interview in Bass Guitar Magazine. So subsequently, I had a 2-page article feature in Bass Guitar Magazine.
I'm very proud of you.
Thank you so much. But it was just like...
And it's just been published on Music Radar.
I know. Tell me about it. It's really bizarre.
Blimey.
But Joel McIver, I must say, I have a huge respect for that man because... He knows people who are established, and he also nurtures young bass players and young musicians, and that's what I love about Joel. So this is what he said about in his book. He said, as the story goes, by the time Carroll came back to the studio to hear the results of when they were recording, the band had recorded no fewer than 11 tracks. Impressed, he paid for more studio time to allow them to complete an album, and the album did well enough to ensure the band would remain together, but it would be their next album, the 1979's Overkill, that proved to be their true breakthrough.
But my favourite Radiohead track name is Kill by Death.
On the night that I passed by her window, I saw the flickering shadows of love on her blind. She was my woman, and as she betrayed me, I watched and went out of my mind. To her house, she opened the door. She stood there laughing, and I felt the knife in my hand, and she laughed no more. Why?
the sensational Alex Harvey Band and Delilah. And that was taken from the Old Grey Whistle Test recording, which was recorded on the 30th of May 1975. And it was actually released as a single, and it reached number 7 in the UK charts. But you can get this recording on an album, Live at the BBC, which was released in 2009.
Well, sensational Alex Harvey Band, we've had them on before. We love these guys, fantastic. This particular performance, when you see it on YouTube, you can just watch it again. It's amazing because Zal Clemenson, the guitar player, is dressed up as a clown, and they're prancing about the stage, like doing like really strange dancing moves. Him and the bass player, who's dressed up in like a skeleton outfit, and it's a fantastic visual spectacle. And he was marvelous at that. Really great, charismatic performer. Of course, when you listen to the recording through headphones again, you forget how much that the BBC were terrified of rock and roll music in the 70s, because the amount of limiting and compression they had on those things was incredible. And they made a bit of a cock at the beginning, because I think there was that synth line.
I heard that. It went bang.
It went right in there. It's like, oh, shit, it's too loud. And they had to turn it down quick, you know.
I thought that too. I thought it just suddenly appeared out of nowhere like a big mountain.
Yeah, and I think they just whipped a load of compression and everything else after that, you know, to the limits and stuff. But you know, this live, man, absolutely live. And that, you know, it's a great performance. You can hear the energy, you know.
Yeah. But you can't imagine the fact that when he's singing that, there's loads of mannequins there in the studio, and he's ripping wigs off them in the middle of, and just like messing around, and that tomfoolery or that spectacle, you just can't hear it, can you? Because it's not in the music, which is lovely. So the music allows your imagination to go where it wants to go, if you know what I mean.
But what I love about this band is that they didn't work with any right big name producers. That the guys, they weren't like Frontline, you know, the studios they worked in weren't. What they had was they just had an inherent ability to create great original music that was. And it was original because, you know, you listen to Next, you listen to all these albums. They're beautiful. And the actual studio version of Delilah is very interesting as well. But I like this one better because we love live, don't we?
I do love that. And I was thinking, well, who is this dude, Alex Harvey, you know? And he was born in the Gorbals area of Glasgow. And he had a number of jobs, as most people do. But, I mean, really, maybe back in those days, I think, you would have a job and really stay at it a lot of the time. If you changed job more than once a year, you were kind of frowned upon, weren't you? But he was a carpenter. He worked as a waiter in a restaurant. He was carving tombstones, of all things. It was just interesting.
Yeah.
Well, my grandfather was a stonemason.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. So it's a beautiful skill to have. And I love working with wood, so I love that kind of medium and carving with that. And he also won a competition in Scotland, which is looking for the answer to Tommy Steele, the new Tommy Steele.
No.
Oh, yeah. So he won this talent competition. So, I mean, there's a journey this guy's gone on. And he was also working in the Pitt Orchestra for musical Hair.
Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. So it's like what I love is the journey of somebody, because he's taken different influences. You can see that this kind of theatre, this theatrical performance of his, and you can see that he's at home in that environment, really, that theatrical performance that he gives.
Well, he is. Yeah. I mean, it's clear that he loves it, and he's very, very good at it as well, you know. And I am slightly wrong in the fact that the album Next, which was about 1973, was it? Yeah. That was recorded at Apple Studios. So it was the studio set up by the Beatles and designed by Jeff Emerick, you know. So they did obviously work with some, you know, cool, because they were on Universal at that time.
Do you know what I like, though? I just can't wait to play some more. What a great name for a band. The Sensational Alex Harvey Band.
A heart on the run, keeps a hand on the gun. You can't trust him. I was so sure what I needed was more. Tried to shoot out the sun. Days when we're
much damage is done. But I made it through, 'cause somebody knew I was meant for someone. So go leave your boots by the bed. We ain't leaving this room. But someone needs medical help or the magnolias. It's cold in this house and I ain't going out to chop. Cover me up and know you're enough to use me for good. Put your faith to the test when I tore off your dress in Richmond on high. I sobered up and I swore off that stuff forever this time. The old lover's scene, I thought it'd be me who helped him get home. But home was a dream, one I'd never seen till you came.
Magnificent Jason Isbell, Cover Me Up, from his fourth studio album, Southeastern, released in 2013 on Southeastern Records. Well, there we are.
Who is Jason Isbell?
What are you going to tell me? I don't know a right lot about him. All I do know is that when I heard this album, I rushed out and bought it. It sounds beautiful. We love Dave Cobb.
Yeah.
The engineer-producer. He did his vocals in one take a lot of the times. He works so much like we do. We love him. And there's not a lot of big name session guys on that, you know. I mean, there's a few, but his wife, who just married after this, playing fiddle on some of the tracks. But, you know, it's fantastic. And it's all about the song, because country music is, you know, Gram Parsons, we listened to, we've got an album, haven't we? The Gram Parsons album.
Everybody
raves about the Gram Parsons album and everything's fantastic. And we put it on and it doesn't do anything to us. It makes us feel a bit cold, to tell the truth. But this, if this is modern country music, this is great.
Well, I don't even think of it as country. I think of it as a folk song, actually, would you believe? For me, it's a guy with a guitar, and I wouldn't think it was country or folk. I would say more acoustic folk to me than country.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and
this is home. Yeah. This is what I've always grown up with.
Yeah. And the guitar sounds so beautiful, and the line is so great. And, you know, I've been a bit of a geek, of course. I watched a Rig Rundown,
It's great. Yeah. I love it. And I see,
because
you're so happy when I see you watch these.
Yeah, and I'm watching the guitar players and him. And he's a lovely guy, actually. And he really cares about his instruments. So, you know, he plays some lovely instruments. And he's a cool guy. And he's headlining at, is it this year? Or was it last year at the Byron Bay? I think it was last year, wasn't it? I think he was on last year, Jason. But yeah, but fantastic, you know, artist. Anyway, who is he?
Well,
talk to me about it.
He was born in Greenhill, Alabama, which is 2 miles from the Alabama-Tennessee state line. And his mum had him when she was 17. So she was an interior designer, and his dad was, Mike, was a house painter. And his grandparents used to live on a farm down the road where he used to go to school. So they used to look after him when his parents were at work. And his grandfather and uncle, they taught him to play various instruments. So by the age of 6, he was playing mandolin, which is quite beautiful. But but I think mandolin suits tiny fingers as well, because it's a good little instrument for a young one. And he was sort of surrounded by bluegrass and gospel music and the Grand Ole Opry, which is a beautiful place in Nashville in terms of its heritage of country music.
Yeah, what's the word? It's the centre of country, really.
It is. It's the heartbeat.
The heartbeat, the bastion of all things country.
A theatre space where everybody played there. And in high school, this is what I love about it, when I read about this, he played trumpet and French horn.
Rather like you, darling.
Get in there.
Well, French horn anyway.
Well, exactly. The French horns are really difficult. It's most difficult of all the brass instruments. And I love that, because I share that with him. But by the age of 16, he'd actually gone and played the Grand Ole Opry.
Blimey.
Now, what I didn't know was that he was a member of the Drive-By Truckers.
Right.
Now, I my mate Julian Knight, who's really helped me in terms of introducing me to loads of really obscure artists years, you know, when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
I used to ask him, like, what are you listening to now? And he'd write me a list, or he used to make me mixtapes as well. And now that's how I know about the Drive-By Truckers. But I didn't know this. And do you know them? Because I don't really know the Drive-By Truckers. In fact, we should have them on the show.
Yeah, we should. And we will do. I don't have any albums by the brand. So if we're going to play it, of course.
We'll have to get one.
We'll have to buy
one.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's all right.
Yeah, no, that's cool. But what I really like as well, going back to his upbringing and the way he was formed, is that he was hanging out. And a lot of musicians, they took him under his wing. And so he ended up sort of hanging out and jamming with a guy called Patterson Hook and his future Drive-By Truckers co-founder, Mike Cooley. And then he kind
Not
of...
Not Cooler.
No, Cooley.
Excellent.
Yeah, well, we can't really say what that... Well, culo is your
bottom.
Bottom.
It's all right. In Spanish.
In Spanish. See. So he used to then, once he admitted he's quite shy that he played, they'd let him sit in and they mentored him and they nurtured him. And at age 21, he got a publishing deal with Fame Studios of Muscle Shoals, Alabama. Mm. And then a year later, he was in Drive-By Truckers. Yeah. And that's all I wanted to know. And that he's won a few Grammys. And that's lovely too. But what I just wanted to know is where his roots were, because the rest of it is up to him to tell me through his music. I don't really want to know so much more.
Well, what I love, though, about Dave Cobbs, coming back to the production again.
Yeah, I like Dave Cobbs.
I think he's really released him, you know, from I don't know. He sort of released his sound for some, and this is connected with everybody. I mean, it's done massively well, hasn't it, this album?
Yeah, four
Grammys, not so okay.
He's won four Grammys in his lifetime.
But anyway, it's an incredible, record, a beautiful production, and it just goes to show the power of a great recording and a great recording studio and a great producer with a fabulous artist.
In the deserts of Sudan and the gardens of Japan, from Milan to Yucatan, every woman's every man. Hit me with your rhythm stick, hit me, hit me, je t'adore, ich liebe dich. Hit me, hit me, hit me, hit me with your rhythm stick, hit me slowly, hit me quick, hit me.
Listening to the Supertones Show with Susie Starlight and Simon Campbell of the Starlight Campbell Band.
And you did the ident for a change.
I did.
Hey, that was Hit Me With Your Rhythm Stick by Ian Dury and the Blockheads. And that was first released as a single, both in 7-inch and 12-inch versions on Stiff Records on the 23rd of November, way back when, in 1978.
Yeah, well, I mean, Ian Dury and the Blockheads, fabulous band. Norman Watroy on bass.
Don't talk to me about 16 notes per blinking bar bass line, that bass Norman
line,
Rockroy.
It is so groovy. It's fiendishly groovy. It's not just groovy. It's groovy with an extra helping of groove. With a side order of groove and then with a load of extremely groovy sauce.
I agree.
It's beautiful.
Do you know what I love, though, is when he goes to the chorus, he calms it right down, just grooves back in, and then he starts off like this busy bee again, but it's like...
But it doesn't sound over much. I mean, there's a lot of notes in there, but it doesn't sound over much, because the track is so simple that, you know, that there's a lot of space in the track, and that's what they're really, really good at. And this was recorded again live. Thank God. Live, yes. With Ian Dury in the middle of the room with a handheld mic, and everybody was positioned in the studio. Laurie Latham was producing it, very famous producer in the 80s, 70s. And, you know, really, really, apparently they had terrible trouble at the mix because everybody got involved and they all wanted to push faders. And I think they're all.
Usually the guitar players always want the guitars too high in the mix.
Yeah, well, there we go. You see.
Don't, but I know that there are people that do that. It's funny anyway.
Well, they do. And because everybody wants their own instrument, they don't actually think about the song, you know, they don't listen to it. And it's difficult, I think, when you're
doing
a mix.
It is difficult, I was going to say, actually, as well.
As an instrumentalist, because you always. And I always try and err on the side of caution, so I always mix certainly my guitar a bit lower than I would expect. Mm. But even when it comes out, it sounds about right, I suppose.
And I know, and I don't mean that to be placatory about you. It's just that I know that our focus when we go to mix a song is all about the song that we're serving it. So we'll play a bass or a guitar or the drums or whatever it is. It'll all be about that final vision. It's not about whether or not we can be heard, as it were. But, I mean, that was their most successful single. It sold like 1.3 million copies, went to number one in the UK singles charts in January 1979. It was the top three in Ireland, New Zealand and Australia. And it would have got to the number one. Here's a trivia question for you. Are you paying attention?
I am.
It would have got to number one, but it was held off for 2 weeks by a certain song by... Guess who?
Oh, I don't know. It's going to be somebody. It's going to be something horrible, isn't it? Yes. Go on. I don't know.
You're going to take you to the YMCA.
No. that's a cool song,
It is a cool song, actually. But the Village People. The Village People and their classic track. How cool is that? And I was thinking about this as well, you know, with this song. I think it's probably one of the very, very few songs where the sax isn't dated. Well, I actually feel like it sounded like almost like a synth instrument. It was quite back in the mix. It didn't always sound like a saxophone. It was very textural. So, comes in, that bit.
He plays two at the same time. He's playing two sax at the same time. Interesting.
I'm just playing that line.
I've got to say that we're having a few glasses of wine tonight because we've had some very good news this week as a band. We've had a lot of good news, actually. So
it's been a really beautiful, wonderful, surreal. Yeah.
We're on the Kerris show on Monday night, which was brilliant.
We had our debut play on BBC Radio 2, which is the national radio station in the UK.
So we're very excited. And, you know, but, you know, we love doing these shows. We always feel great when we do it, and we always feel better after doing them because we sort of getting something out about our lives. It's just like projecting our life on a big screen, really, because it's all about the music in this house.
And
that's it. But anyway,
it's like a child in Willy Wonka's factory going back to eating the chocolate when we do the show. It's like, this is where we belong.
It always reminds us what we're supposed to be doing. That's exactly. Writing and recording music. And every time I think about this and listen to it, I think, right, we need our new mixing console. I need to get out there and we need to start recording again and all that sort of stuff, you know?
It is very inspirational.
It is.
And I like that because it's like being friends with other people as well.
Anyway, we have some good news this morning, but we can't tell you about that yet.
Well, we're driving through Wiltshire. Very nice countryside, sky, ground, all that sort of thing. Natural marriage of natural resources. And I'm looking out the window, because I don't come from that part of the world, and I said, what's that over there? It was sort of... a sort of low, grey, concrete thing. It was all surrounded by fields, really nice trees, but there was this sort of low, like a sort of a large square of concrete, like the foundations of a building that hadn't been built. it had little walls, a little about a foot high or something, it looked like that, maybe 2 foot high, 2 foot high. And in fact, it was a sort of the top of it, and it was a sort of flat roof. And I thought, oh, I see. And then I pointed as a car got past it. I said, what was that? And the country person who was with me said, that's where they keep pigs. I thought, oh, yes, I see, that's where they keep pigs. And the sun was shining down, and the grass was green, and it was all very lovely driving the country. And I suddenly thought that what that building must have been like from the inside. Pigs. In there. Pigs. In there.
Pigs in There, from the compilation album EPs, released on the 9th of February 1999 by Domino Records and Thirsty Ear Records. You know,
Robert Wyatt.
I love that guy. We had Shipbuilding on some weeks ago, and every time I hear it, it makes me cry. That's from the Ogre Test as well. And this, again, it is so different. I mean, yeah, it's got that modern thing going on. It's this drum machine. It's got, you know, it's got that synth in it. But he really, really makes it work.
I think we're going to call it retro-modern, because modern doesn't exist anymore. It's a very dated term. So I reckon that was retro-modern, post-modern. I'm joking.
Proto. I don't know what proto... I've never understood what proto, because of proto-metal, proto-plasm, I don't know. It's proto something. Everything's proto these days. Are we proto-blues? I don't know. I think perhaps we might be.
I
don't care. So Robert Wyatt, we love him. You know, we got some Soft Machine Records. Great artist. Just love him. Really do love him.
And it's odd, though, because I can hear their pigs.
In there. And it's that syncopation, pigs.
You could fuse the two.
Great, you know.
But
really.
Do you know what this came from? And I didn't know that he'd actually written the music for a film called Animals. And this was one of the songs that he'd written for the script, for the soundtrack, this film. But it didn't make the final film. And it was a film narrated by Julie Christie, released in 1981. And it was a really quite a prolific film in terms of its timing. It was a survey of the uses of animals in factory farming and as pets and for entertainment and military research, hunting, and it also profiled the international animal rights movement. And it was incredible because Channel 4 was only like 3 days old, and they screened the whole of it by about 7 minutes or something. And off the back of it, it was so such a key film at that time. Elvis Costello stopped eating meat after watching it. And I don't think anything had been so... It was passed by the film board, but when it went to TV, it was actually censored a bit because they felt it could incite riots. It was that they'd never seen footage of inside laboratories and things before, and that graphic all put together in a package. But
that brutal, you know, that brutal media thing or brutal documentary thing now is, you know, it's difficult to shock people anymore now, isn't it? It's really, really hard. And you know, and the funny thing is now is that we are we find it easy to watch people being murdered in films and murdered all over the place with some horrific, horrible, diabolical scenes. But when you see an animal under stress or being murdered or mistreated, it kind of moves you more. What does that say?
The Art of Dying by George Harrison from his triple album All Things Must Pass, which was released on the 27th of November in 1970 on the Apple label.
Eric Clapton on guitar. In fact, it was Derek and the Dominos, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, near enough.
Who was on bass? Your mate, Carl Radle, your little idol there.
I love Carl Radle.
Great player. And Clapton said they really made the bones of that. Of their band when they did this album.
Of course, yeah, when they got together. It was co-produced by Phil Spector as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, and without a load of reverb, which is incredible. It was quite rocky, really. And I saw something about this, saying it was proto-disco. Talking of proto, I don't know. I don't know what proto-disco is.
Well, you know, sometimes I love to talk about these phraseologies, but it's the end of the show, you know.
No!
I thought I'd get in there first this week. It's always you.
Right, well, if you want to contact us, we're on Instagram, Starlight Campbell, that's S-T-A-R-L-I-T-E. Twitter, Susie and Simon, and Facebook, of course.
Yeah, we did know because we realised that we've got to get onto the next track really quick. And then also you can find us on Mixcloud, Spotify, iTunes and iHeartRadio. Please tell your friends.
And the last track is by one of our favourite artists of all time, Pink Floyd, but nothing from the later albums. It's from Metal. And, you know, great track, dead chill, dead relaxed. We can't play it all, sadly, but...
Well, you know, it's called Fearless. It's from the sixth studio album released in October 1971. And the one thing that occurred to me as we were just about to do this, that the music from 1971 is far more fashionable than the fashion in the clothes.
As I rise above the trees.